Welcome to tonight's session on the Gospel of Mark. We're in session 5 tonight, Disciples, Healings, and Conflict. Let's look in Mark chapter 1 where we left off. Now we've been looking at the setup for how Mark is getting the beginning of the gospel going with Jesus coming on as the main protagonist, being chosen by God, having temptations and overcoming them in the wilderness against Satan, and then ultimately beginning his public ministry, announcing that the time has been fulfilled, that the kingdom of God has drawn near, and therefore people everywhere should repent and believe the good news. The scene then immediately changes to the calling of the first disciples. Verse 16 goes like this, "And as he was passing alongside the Sea of Galilee, he saw Simon and Andrew, the brother of Simon, casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. And Jesus said to them, 'Follow me, and I will have you fish for people.' And immediately they left their nets and followed him. And going on a little further, he saw James, the son of Zebedee, and his brother John, and they were in their boat mending the nets. And immediately he called them, and they left their father Zebedee in the boat with the hired servants and followed him." This first scene here where Jesus is calling his disciples, Peter and Andrew, James and John, these fishermen in Galilee, it doesn't give us much description of any interaction. Jesus just hails to them while they're working and beckons for them to follow him. And they don't enter into a dialogue or kind of like want to understand the terms or anything like that. It says that they immediately left what they were doing and followed Jesus. In a previous session, we talked about the way that Mark uses this adverb immediately more than any other gospel by far. He does it to kind of propel the storyline forward. And he kind of telescopes a lot of things into a very short kind of duration. Here, we don't know if they would have had more conversation or not, but that wasn't what Mark wanted to focus on. Mark wanted to focus on the radical commitment of these individuals to Jesus when he called for them, and they abandoned their occupation to follow him. I think this portrays in a vivid way the power and authority that Jesus had, and people apparently recognized it. This rabbi from Nazareth, for them to leave their profession, to leave their family and follow this man under such unlikely circumstances as this, shows a resolution on their part that they have determined to make this their course of life. I think this portrayal is meant to picture the radical departure from the past that is required to be a disciple of Jesus. John just focuses on the way that these individuals, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, shifted, without question, just shifted their life to become followers of Jesus. And while this is how Mark presents the calling of the disciples, there seems to be other clues that perhaps they might have already been acquainted with him or had already talked with him beforehand, as sometimes later in the Gospels we'll see that they get a boat and they're able to help him be able to navigate around the Sea of Galilee, which seems like they had talked and been able to figure things out ahead of time to some degree. Now, similarly with James and John, the decisive redirection of their lives and the severing of family ties and responsibility is just as radical and unexpected as that of Peter and Andrew, or here named Simon. Simon is the name for Peter. Now, the way that the next chapter or so is structured is that there are a sequence of encounters with healings that Jesus does. And so there are 4 healings that I want us to go through and look at. First, Jesus will cast out an unclean spirit. Then he will heal many in Capernaum around Galilee. Then he will heal a man with a skin disease. And then he will heal a paralyzed man. So let's look at the first healing incident. Jesus casts out an unclean spirit. Mark 1, verses 21 to 28. It says, "And they went into Capernaum, and immediately on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue and began to teach." This is Jesus. "And they were astonished at his teaching, because He was teaching them as one who had authority and not as the experts in the law. And immediately there was a man in their synagogue with an unclean spirit. And he cried out saying, "What do you want with us, Jesus of Nazareth? Have you come to destroy us? I know who you are, the Holy One of God." And Jesus subdued him, saying, "Be bound and come out of him." And after throwing him into convulsions and crying with a loud voice, the unclean spirit came out of him. This unclean spirit in this person, it shrieks and cries out. And the spirit accurately identifies who Jesus is. The spirit knows that Jesus is the Holy One of God. And so while the person is demon possessed by a single spirit, when the spirit speaks, it speaks in the plural and says, "What do you want with us? Have you come to destroy us?" It's as if the unclean spirit is speaking on behalf of the demonic world at large and expressing their fear of the power of God's kingdom that Jesus has been empowered to wield as God's chosen and beloved son. The encounter with this demon-possessed person is really a portrayal of the clash of the kingdoms. And Jesus utters only two statements to the spirit. One, "Be bound," and two, "Come out of him." And that is enough to command this spirit's obedience and demonstrating that Jesus has authority over Satan's realm. This opening scene is a real concrete example of God's power and authority being visible and manifest through Jesus, who is God's chosen emissary. And thus, this episode is a thematic prelude for the motif of how Jesus is bringing the power and the presence of God's kingdom throughout Mark's gospel. In verse 27, in response to this, it says the people there in the synagogue, they were all amazed. And so they debated among themselves, saying, "What is this? A new teaching with authority?" And he commands even the unclean spirits, and they obey him. And the news about him immediately went out everywhere into all the surrounding region of Galilee. So here, this opening scene where Jesus heals this person with an unclean spirit, people are amazed by it. They can't believe what Jesus is doing and the way he is teaching. Something about how Jesus is sort of presenting himself, they recognize authority. And that's why they say, "What is this? A new teaching with authority?" It's different than what the scribes and the Pharisees and the experts in the law and the way that they taught. Jesus is bringing a new, kind of like a new regime here and a new sort of like way to demonstrate God's power, the power of God's kingdom. So then we move into the second healing, which is where Jesus heals a lot of people in the area of Capernaum. Again, we see, and immediately as we move along in the narrative here, after coming out of the synagogue, they went with James and John into the house of Simon and Andrew. Now, Simon's mother-in-law was lying down sick with a fever. And immediately they told him about her, and he came and took her by the hand and raised her up, and the fever left her, and she began to serve them. Jesus hears of a need of Simon's mother-in-law being sick. He goes there. He reaches out, takes her hand, lifts her up. She is healed, and then she turns and begins serving them. In verse 32, and when evening came, after the sun had set, they brought to him everyone who was sick and those who were afflicted by demons. And the whole city was gathered together at the door. And he healed many who were sick with various diseases and cast out many demons. And he did not allow the demons to speak because they knew him. So after healing one person, then when the evening came, multitudes came to Jesus, those who had physical illnesses and those who had spiritual illnesses or demon possession, demon affliction. And Jesus healed them. And it says, with regard to the demons, he did not allow the demons to speak. This is something that is often known as the messianic secret in the Gospel of Mark. Here in verse 34, we get kind of a glimpse of this motif, which will recur multiple times throughout Mark's gospel, where Jesus repeatedly works to conceal his identity as the Messiah and Son of God. And it shows up in many places, especially when Jesus tells spirits or people not to reveal who he is after performing healings, miracles, exorcisms, or when a confession of identity or a declaration of recognition is given. Now, Mark does not tell us necessarily exactly why Jesus is trying to conceal his identity and not letting the demons declare who he is. There have been a couple theories of what this could serve in Mark's narrative. One would be to prevent misunderstanding, that people in that time, in the Jewish culture, they were expecting a particular type of Messiah. They were expecting a political and a military leader, someone who would liberate them from the oppression of Rome and other surrounding nations. And Jesus wanted to redefine what kind of a Messiah he was. Or perhaps it was about timing. Perhaps Jesus wanted his identity to be fully revealed only later and not early on in his ministry, but after he had gone through the suffering and the death and the resurrection, but not before that time. And there's a place later on in Mark 9 we'll look at when he actually mentions that. And then lastly, it could be to develop narrative tension. And this is where Mark is sort of building this dramatic suspense, where as one is reading the gospel, the reader comes to know who Jesus is early on. But the characters in the gospel, in the narrative, as the story's developing, they struggle to really understand who Jesus is. So it could be a combination of some of these or something else, but this is definitely something Mark does in his presentation of Jesus, is that he has Jesus declaring multiple times that people and spirits, that they're not to reveal his identity. I'm moving on to the next healing in verse 35. It says, "And getting up very early in the morning, while it was still dark, he left the house and departed into a solitary place and prayed there. And Simon and those who were with him went searching for him, and they found him and said to him, 'Everyone is looking for you.' And he said to them, 'Let's go somewhere else, into the nearby towns, so that I can preach there also. That is why I came.' And he went throughout all Galilee, preaching in their synagogues and casting out demons. And a man with a serious skin disease came to him, kneeling down and pleading with him and saying to him, 'If you are willing, you are able to make me clean.' And being moved with compassion, he stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, 'I am willing, be clean.' And immediately the skin disease left him and he was made clean. And after he sternly warned him, immediately he sent him away and said to him," here we go, "'see to it that you don't say anything to anyone, but go show yourself to the priest and offer the things that Moses commanded for your cleansing as a testimony to them.'" So after healing this man with a skin disease, he also tells the individual, "Don't tell anybody that I healed you. Don't tell anybody about this. Just go and do the cleansing that you normally would." Now, the man with the skin disease, this is likely a case of leprosy, which is a very common skin disease back in the ancient world. And it shows Jesus willing to violate social and religious norms, because as a leper or as someone with a skin disease in the Jewish culture, you were not allowed to touch that individual, or you would become ritually unclean yourself. So Jesus touches him, which if you're reading this as like a first century Jewish reader, I think we would be shocked. We'd be shocked to see what Jesus is doing. It is so outside the box. But he's unafraid. He's showing that he has a mission that supersedes the expectations of others. And so Jesus brings this physical, and not only physical, social restoration to this man, because he had to stay outside the city. He was not allowed to be among the people and part of the community. He was ostracized. But Jesus redeems that and restores him back, showing that no one is too unclean to be made whole. And so his compassion for this man overrides all the purity laws of the old covenant, exhibiting the priority of loving and serving one another, contrary to, as we will see, the legalism of the Jewish religious leaders. Now, verse 45, but he went out. So this man went out and began to widely proclaim it. He began to tell everybody about what Jesus had done and to spread the news so that Jesus was no longer able to openly enter into a city, but stayed outside in unpopulated areas. And yet they kept coming to him from everywhere. Report of Jesus and Jesus's reputation got spread around by this individual, so much so that his popularity grew to where he couldn't actually go into a town because he would be inundated and swamped and people would just, like a frenzy, flock to him. And so people kept coming. He was doing something new and people recognized it. Now the fourth healing here is in chapter 2, where Jesus heals a paralyzed man. And it says when he entered again back into Capernaum, after some days, because they had gone to preach elsewhere in other cities. So as they returned back, it was reported that he was at home. Capernaum was Jesus's kind of home base. He had a residence there and it was sort of like his headquarters for where he then did his ministry outreach around the region of Galilee. And so many people were gathered together that there was no more room, not even around the door. And he was speaking the word to them. And they came, bringing to him a paralyzed man who was being carried by four men. And when they were not able to bring the man to him because of the crowd, they uncovered the roof where he was. And when they had dug through it, they lowered the bed that the paralyzed man was lying on. And when he saw their trust, Jesus said to the paralyzed man, "Child, your sins are forgiven." Interesting here that the focus is on the circumstances here where Jesus was inaccessible due to the crowd. But yet this one man who was paralyzed had friends who would help him. And they tore a hole in the roof and lowered the man down to where Jesus was. And the first thing Jesus does is not physically heal the man, but address his spiritual wounds. He says, "Child, your sins are forgiven." This moment is kind of a shift where Jesus is addressing the spiritual dimension first, and then we'll move to the physical need. And this is kind of a theological climax here of this sequence of healings, where Jesus is no longer just healing the bodies of people, but now he's claiming the authority to forgive sin and to spiritually heal people. And this, as we will see, will now segue by provoking the religious leaders into conflict with Jesus. So the rest of the section we will be covering deals with a sequence of conflicts. There are five conflicts in a row that all kind of escalate to a climax that we'll get to. The first conflict is Jesus is questioned about forgiving sins. Then Jesus is questioned about eating with sinners. Jesus is then questioned about fasting. And then Jesus is questioned about the Sabbath. And then finally, Jesus questions and defies the Pharisees. So the first conflict comes right on the heels of what we were reading about. So after telling the paralyzed man that his sins are forgiven, some of the experts in the law were sitting and reasoning in their hearts, "Why does this man speak this way? He speaks blasphemy. Who can forgive sins except God alone?" And immediately, when Jesus perceived in his spirit that they were reasoning that way within themselves, he said to them, "Why are you reasoning about these things in your hearts? Which is easier, to say to the paralyzed man, 'Your sins are forgiven,' or to say, 'Get up and pick up your pallet and walk'? But so that you know the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins," he said to the paralyzed man, "I say to you, get up, pick up your pallet, and go to your house. And he got up and immediately picked up the pallet and left the house in front of them all. As a result, they were all amazed and glorified God, saying, "We have never seen anything like this." The religious leaders standing by, upon hearing Jesus talk about forgiving sins, it immediately draws their attention to a quandary. How is this man saying that he can forgive sins? Because in their eyes, only God was able to forgive sins. But see, this is because they did not understand who Jesus was. They did not understand the way that God had chosen him to be his emissary, his representative, his empowered agent, and that he had received the authority by God to not only forgive sins, but also to render judgment as well. So the Pharisees take offense at this, and then he questions them in return with a rhetorical question of like, "Well, you tell me which one's easier. Is it easier for you to heal somebody or to tell them that their sins are forgiven? And the sins that are being forgiven are not, 'I forgive your sin against me.'" Jesus is pronouncing the forgiveness of their sins against God, that their sins have been cleansed, so that he can show that the Son of Man, he says, has the authority to do this. He then heals the man, tells him, "Get up, take your pallet, go home." The man does it in front of them all, and everybody cannot believe it. The conflict with their religious leaders has turned into a spectacle that shows the power of Jesus over the infirmities of this paralyzed man. And he says in verse 13, for the next conflict after this, it says, "And again, he went out beside the lake." This is the Sea of Galilee. "And a large crowd was coming to him, and he was teaching them. And as he passed by, he saw Levi, the son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. And he said to him, 'Follow me.' And he got up and followed him." Levi is at work, much like Peter and Andrew and James and John. And Jesus just tells Levi, "Follow me." And he leaves his post. He leaves everything he's doing as a tax collector behind and decides to follow Jesus. This is the way that Mark is portraying Jesus calling his disciples. He tells them, "I have a mission for you," and they agree. And then they change their entire orientation of life to become followers of Jesus. It says, verse 15, "It came to pass that he was reclining to eat in his house," in Levi's house, the tax collector's house. "And many tax collectors and sinners were reclining and eating with Jesus and his disciples, for there were many who were following him. And when the experts in the law, who were Pharisees, saw that he was eating with sinners and tax collectors, they said to his disciples, 'Why is he eating with tax collectors and sinners?' And when Jesus heard this, he said to them, 'Those who do well do not need a physician, but those who are sick do. I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners.'" So Jesus calls a disciple, Levi, and then goes and has dinner with him at his house. Now, what's wrong with that? Nothing except the guests. Jesus is dining with tax collectors and sinners, of which a respectable Jewish rabbi would never do. They would separate themselves from the lower kind of like caste of society and the people who would be living in sinful lifestyles. They would not associate with them. But Jesus is doing that. And not just Jesus, also his disciples. And so when the religious leaders here, they see this, the experts in the law, which were the Pharisees, they wondered, "Why are you doing this?" And he tells them why. He says, "Because these people need the physician. It's not healthy people who need help. It's the sick people." And so he's with, quote, the sick are the ones who need reform in their life, who need that spiritual healing, who need to be reunited with their God and Father. And so that's why he said, "I did not come to call the righteous, but sinners. Next, Jesus is questioned about fasting. In verse 18, goes and says, John's disciples then were there, and the Pharisees were fasting, and they came and said to him, "Why do John's disciples and the Pharisees' disciples fast, but your disciples do not fast?" So both John's disciples and the Pharisees are doing this fasting, but they notice the followers of Jesus are not following suit. Huh, why are they not doing what we're doing? They should be doing what we're doing. So they asked Jesus, "Why do your disciples not fast?" And Jesus said to them, "Can the wedding guests fast while the groom is still with them?" I can imagine one of the Pharisees being like, what are you talking about? Because Jesus just breaks into kind of this little pseudo parable, more like an analogy, you might say. But the wedding guests, he's saying, would they fast while the groom is still with them? In their culture, that would never happen. If the groom is present, the groomsmen and the guests of the wedding would celebrate with him. Now it says, as long as they have the groom with them, they cannot fast. But he says, the days will come when the groom is taken away from them, and then they will fast in that day. This is probably a very perplexing thing to the Pharisees, is they're not trailing or following with who is this groom and when is this day that the groom will not be there. But this is Jesus kind of like foretelling of future events that we will learn about later on in the gospel. But for this moment, as we're reading this narrative, I bet you as a reader, I think we could also be scratching our head a little bit as to what is Jesus alluding to here? How does this solve the question about fasting, which was a ritualistic question under the old covenant laws? So he says, no one sews a piece of unshrunk cloth on an old garment, otherwise the patch pulls away from it, and the new patch from the old cloth, and the tear becomes worse. And no one puts new wine into old wineskins, otherwise the wine will burst the wineskins, and the wine is ruined, and so are the wineskins. Instead, new wine is put into fresh wineskins. This is just an elaborate explanation Jesus gives to say, you don't do something new with something old. I'm doing something new here, and I'm doing something different, and I'm not combining it with the old. And the old would be the ritualistic ways of the old covenant and the things that the Pharisees are promoting, the traditions that they're trying to advocate for. And Jesus is here to bring something new. He's here with the message of the kingdom, and it is this new venture, this fresh beginning of something that is inaugurated with his coming. And so, you don't do what he's doing in the way that the old is doing it, the Pharisees and John's disciples. And as we read on, we'll see that Jesus' ministry develops in a whole new way apart from the religious orders of the day and the Jewish religious institutions and leaders. So then the fourth conflict is that Jesus is now questioned about the Sabbath. Verse 23, and it came to pass that he was going through the grain fields on the Sabbath. And as they made their way, his disciples began to pick heads of grain. And the Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is not lawful on the Sabbath?" And he said to them, "Have you never read what David did when he was in need and was hungry? He and those who were with him, how he went into the house of God during the time of Abiathar, the high priest, and he ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful to eat, except by the priests. And he also gave some to those who were with him. And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for people, not people for the Sabbath. For this reason, the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." If you were a Jewish religious leader in that day, and you heard somebody say that they were the Lord of the Sabbath, I think you'd be irate. It would be unthinkable to hear Jesus saying this type of language and these sort of expressions to the religious leaders. But what he's doing is he's showing that he is setting a new precedent, just like we read about in the previous conflict, that he is overturning and flipping upside down expectations and the cultural and religious norms of the day to bring the message of the kingdom. And so then after these conflicts, which are each one escalating to now the point of Jesus is declaring his authority as the Son of Man, and he's saying that the Sabbath wasn't meant to bind people, but people were meant to for the Sabbath, that it was meant to serve them, and therefore people were more important than the Sabbath. And that Jesus was saying that in the kingdom, this is the way that things are. That people matter, not the laws and the rituals, such as the Sabbath keeping and the fasting. And so then next, Jesus turns and then he questions the authorities. So in Mark chapter 3, verse 1, and he, Jesus, went into the synagogue again, and a man was there with a shriveled hand. So he sees a man with a physical need. And it says, and they, the Pharisees and the experts in the law, they were watching him closely to see if he would heal on the Sabbath. Would Jesus violate one of the most sacrosanct rituals of the old covenant to observe the Sabbath? And they did this so that they could accuse him. They wanted to see him break the law. And he said to the man who had the shriveled hand, get up in the midst of the people. And he said to them all, is it lawful on the Sabbath to do good or to do harm, to save a life or to kill? But they remained silent. They did not know how to answer him. Jesus is now showing that he has an authority greater than theirs, that he is coming to do something above the expectations that they had. And so looking around, he becomes angry with them. Jesus is now showing emotion for their stubborn and obstinate hearts. And he's grieved at the hardness of their hearts. And he said to the man, stretch out your hand. And the man stretched it out, and his hand was restored. And the Pharisees went out and immediately began plotting with the Herodians against him, Jesus, how to destroy him. So this sequence here of these five conflicts escalates to a fever pitch where Jesus shows that the power of God to heal a person is showing love and compassion upon them, even in spite of the Sabbath observance that all the people thought were supposed to happen. And Jesus shows that it's more important for people to be cared for and ministered to. And that is the ethic of the kingdom that he brings and is demonstrating through his ministry. But this then comes to the climax where the religious leaders have had enough. They see that he is trouble and they now want to destroy him. In the next session, we're going to continue to see how Jesus forms his initial community of the 12 apostles and expands the ministry of preaching the kingdom.